Hello, my name is Martijn Leijenberger from Aspic Noordwijk.
And my name is Maaike Smelter from NL Space Campus. Welcome to this episode, second episode of the podcast Uncover Space. Today, we will do some community updates by Aspic and NL Space Campus and the ecosystem. And of course, we have a guest, Philip Schoonejans. We'll discuss space exploration and we end with a fun fact. So, Martijn, what's the updates for Aspic Noordwijk?
Thanks for asking. So we have recently had our selection campaign, so we expect a lot of new startups to join the ESABIC Noordwijk program, as well as now we provide the opportunity for other people as well to make use of our community and co-working space by book a desk for a day. And your updates?
Thank you. I have a couple more updates. So first, I would like to ask all drone operators pay attention because the 2nd of April, there's a 2.5-hour hands-on workshop at the Galileo Reference Center in Noordwijk, which is the program location for EUSPA, the European Union Space Program Agency. And if you work with drones and GNSS, this is a really cool workshop and you can find it on our event calendar and of course on the website of EUSPA. Then on the 27th of March, we have a network and drinks in Rotterdam at Z, which is a high-tech conference. So if you are a high-tech company and you build stuff, this is a really interesting conference to go. You have to register for the conference to actually join network and drinks. Then the summer school registrations have opened. It's going really fast. We actually already have 19 registrations and we only have 45 spots. So if you're really excited about the summer school, please check it out. And also, the first Benelux Space Startup Competition is on the 1st and the 2nd of May. And it's a two-day hackathon or competition. You can start your own company, a space company. There's about 60 spots available, not that many. There's very good sponsors, so it's going to be a really cool event.
It's in Rotterdam, am I right?
It's going to be in Rotterdam, yes. And then you will learn a lot about entrepreneurship, about creating your own space company, and you can even maybe create your own space company if, for example, you win.
That sounds very nice.
I wish I was still a student, actually.
It's only the winner who gets to get his own space company, or the others will find a way too, I guess.
Yes, so the winner gets what the winner gets, but you will never lose your experience, your network, and the people you meet. So we actually experience with competitions and hackathons that a lot of second or third place winners also really start their own company. So now talking about the guest, I would like to introduce Philip Schoonejans, and he is a former researcher space exploration from the European Space Agency, ESA we call it. And we are talking about space exploration and the value of space exploration for our society. Because it holds a lot of interest, of course, and it's not always clear to everyone. So, Philip, welcome.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be here.
Thank you. Welcome. We're super excited.
Yes. I really want to start with asking questions because
go ahead. Indeed.
So, which groundbreaking explorations did you take part in?
Well, I'm actually a big fan of exploration, and I have 33 years behind me in the European Space Agency as a project manager for, I think, 5 major space programs. And I think maybe the biggest one was what's also the biggest Dutch space project. It's a European robotic arm, which is now working on the International Space Station, on the Russian part of the space station, and got launched in 2021. But it was just before the war in Ukraine started, and we were, as one of the few projects in Europe, we were still allowed to continue even after they started fighting in Ukraine. That made it very, very special, because I still remember the days that we were from a small control room. We were operating and supporting the operation from the Russians in real time with all the data here in Noordwijk, in the Netherlands, where we could see real-time videos from the helmets of the astronauts who were busy operating the robot arm. We could see all the data, all the currents, all the temperatures of all the mechanisms, and follow all of that basically for us from home. That was super exciting, and I think that's a very nice addition to the ISS.
ISS, that stands for?
International Space Station. So that goes very, very close to Earth, like 450 kilometers above the Earth's surface. That's about the distance from Amsterdam to Paris. And it's not higher. It's very close to Earth. Therefore, it also goes very fast around Earth.
Yeah, when you're talking about they're working on the robotic arm, you're talking about they're in at ISS, outside in a spacesuit, working on the robot arm? Is that what you're talking about?
They're working with the robot arm. So the robot arm can transport the astronaut. They can stand at the end of it. There's a little pedestal. And so they can be moved around. Since the arm is like 11 and a half meters long, you can move somebody over 22 meters from one part of the ISS to another, which means that they don't have to continuously hook themselves up between every meter that they move, like you would do if you're climbing a mountain. So that's very, very useful. But also there were very, very large payloads of 800 to 1,000 kilos were transported by the robot under the direct control of the astronaut. But things that you cannot move by yourself, because even if it weighs nothing in space, if you give something a big push, you also have to stop it again before it crashes in on the other side of the space station into the hull somewhere. So all of that takes the very, very cautious and slow movement of a space manipulator.
So how did they do before the robot arm? They would just stop?
Those particular tasks, they could not be done. They had to wait for the robot arm to arrive. There were two. There was one scientific airlock, which the Russians are going to use to place experiments outside the ISS, but from inside to outside the ISS.
What kind of experiments are we talking about?
A monitor that has to look into space but cannot look through the hull of the ISS. So anything that you have to put outside, or something looking at the stars, something looking down. But the arm has moved this thing, but it had already been waiting on the ISS for about 10 years. And not being able to do anything with it. The same was for a big radiator that is meant to be used on some part of the Russian part of the ISS, which had also already was already stationed on the ISS for 10 years. And those things had to wait for our arm to come to the ISS to be able to move them around. So that was super interesting. But on ISS, I've also worked on something which is very dear to my heart, on a 3D metal printer. And the printer is now in the ISS. It's printing its first samples.
But like what? What's it printing?
Well, it's like a dedicated set that were engineered or invented for to demonstrate the working of the system and to make sure that you get the right strength of material that you print from it with the right accuracy. Because it's super difficult to print in 3D in weightless condition, because you cannot use powder printing. The powder would go all over the place, and if you have metal powder, it's even explosive. They use printing with wires, and you can have a very thin wire and make layers with a thin wire that you print, and that connects to the previous layer of wires. But if you make a very thin one, you can make something very accurate, but it takes forever. And if you have a thicker one, it goes much faster, but you are not that accurate. So there's also a fine balance to be all, depending on what it is that you want to print. But the future of this is very important, because on a very long travel, let's say to Mars or even further, you can take spare parts for everything that might possibly fail.
Yeah.
So the solution is in the future to take the material with you, and when some part fails, you just the ground station beams the design of the new part to the spaceship. And then you print it in the spaceship and you replace the part. So that's the way longer exploration missions where you have no access to any logistics could be done. So that was a very nice one.
When was it launched again, the ISS?
It was launched in like 30 launches or so, but the first one was in 1998.
Yeah, so it's been up there pretty long time.
Up there for a very, very long time, yeah. And we have to see what's happened to it, but I think we'll talk about that a bit later. And basically, there are three destinations: our International Space Station, very close to Earth, then the Moon, and then to Mars. And for Moon, I was a project manager for one of the elements that Europe is providing for the Lunar Gateway, which is a small space station that's meant to be orbiting the Moon. And the first elements are going to be launched maybe next year or the year after. So that's going to be very, very soon. And our part that we were doing is like a tanking station for the motion of that space station.
Like a gas station.
It's a gas station.
Yeah. Really.
And it has windows, like also they have on ISS, you have also windows where people look down to Earth. Yeah. And now we have windows in a big module where you can look at the moon, because we did discover that it's very important for astronauts to actually be able to look through a window to the moon or to Earth or whatever. It's not the same if you look on a video screen and you have a camera.
Yeah, it, so that's not real. Psychologically, it's important for them to actually look outside of a window.
Yes, and I think in every space station or rocket that's been designed, there's been that discussion. Shall we make a window or not? Because a window is a weak point.
Yes.
Where it's connected to the rest of the metal part, it's possibly leaking. You have maybe 5, 6, 7 layers of glass to prevent that it would break through to micrometeorite or space debris. And still, the conclusion is always, after a lot of discussion, that yes, we have to have a window. If the only thing you can do is look at the camera, then you might as well stay on Earth and beam the image to Earth and then look. What's the difference?
So why don't we?
Because it's very, very inspirational to actually go there and physically find out what something is like. And we want to have also the improvisation talent of a human crew.
Creativity.
Yes, there have been so many repairs that have been done also in the International Space Station. Things that failed and they repaired with duct tape, with paper clips, with whatever. And this has been immensely effective. So the same thing holds also with our systems that we had on the ISS. Things have failed and we were able to go out in a spacewalk and fix it. And that's something that when I later started to work on the Mars robot is really way more difficult. We were working with the Jet Propulsion Lab, which is the NASA lab in California. And they look also at every possible thing that could possibly go wrong with the rovers that drive around on Mars. And it makes it horrendously expensive, because the system has to be able to solve everything by itself. And there's a whole army of engineers that have to figure out what could go wrong and what you would do about it. And many, many of these repairs we could fix when there's people around, because they can just go out and fix it on the spot.
It's very interesting, because I also heard Moon and Mars, but maybe I'm taking your question, but I'm just curious, why do we want to explore that? Why do we want to explore the universe?
Well, I think it's like fundamental science in general. It's something that you want to do something with your curiosity. We want to know better what the world is like around us. And sometimes we only get the benefits like 100 years later, since you don't really know. So it's something to increase our knowledge, we do science. And to increase our knowledge, we also go explore. And we satisfy our curiosity. And there's many examples of things where only years and years and years later, you find out how tremendously useful something has been. And that in itself is very inspiring. And I think here in Europe and in the Netherlands, wherever, we are like a knowledge-based society. We are not very good at producing stuff. We're doing services, we invent stuff. And that means that we have to get our young people into STEM, into science, technology, engineering, mathematics. And there's nothing more inspiring than an exploration mission. And whenever there's people, maybe especially when there's astronauts involved, one astronaut can be more inspiring than 10 of the most absolutely brilliant, fantastic satellites. So I think exploration with robots, but maybe even more so with humans, is so inspiring that it is still something that we want to do.
But that's not the only reason, right? It's not just because we find astronauts inspiring that we send them out to space and we explore Mars.
There's never only one reason.
No.
There's always like a set of reasons. What I personally do not believe in is that we would go to Mars to create a colony on Mars or to have a second planet. I think in the earlier podcast we have had an item saying that NASA had finally decided, after a lot of research, and say that Mars is not really the planet B that we should have for Earth. There's just no way that we could actually live there or transport, let's say, a significant portion of the Earth population to Mars. But we can go there for science. We can go there to figure out what it's like. We can learn about the history of the universe. If you go to either Mars or the Moon, there we have untouched soil where there's been no light, where there's been for billions of years, nobody has touched, done anything with the surface. And on the Earth, we have nothing left of that. We have everything on Earth, every square meter on Earth, we have messed with it or engineered with it or done something with it. And that's totally different on the Moon and Mars. And if really the Moon originates from the Earth, where the going theories that's been knocked out of Earth by a big stone somewhere so many millions of years ago, then that also means that if we study the soil on the Moon, that we learn more about Earth itself. So it's like the geological museum of Earth. And similar line of reasoning could apply for Mars.
So what I'm understanding is that we bring Mars rovers to Mars to learn about Mars or the universe, but Martian missions for people are not going to happen. We're not going to do a colony there. I mean, isn't Elon Musk actually believing we can?
Yeah, and so I don't agree with Elon Musk. That's first of all. But I think we are going to send people to Mars. In my view, no doubt about it. When, that's a second question. But
do you think they can stay alive?
Yes, I think they can, but not in like a mass population there. I think we can send people to Mars for do science or to create maybe a small Mars station where people can live, because they have to live there for 2 years, basically. And because you can only go to Mars once every 2 years, you can only come back once every 2 years.
Oh, okay.
Because Mars goes around the sun in an orbit that takes 2 years. So and the Earth goes in 1 year. So only once per 2 years, then Earth overtakes Mars, and then they're close enough to actually go there. So if you would go there, you would either have to come back almost immediately, or you have to wait for 2 years before you can come back. But I think we will actually do that. We will put people on Mars, but then in a very small research station.
How long does it take to get to Mars?
Today, 9 months or so.
So this is also a little bit of looking ahead, but I'm also from your perspective, personal perspective, what is the exploration history which just really focused the wow feeling?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of missions which could create a wow feeling, but I think if you would ask me what is the one single mission that has the biggest wow feeling, maybe that's still the lunar landing 50 years ago of the Apollo missions. Now, because that's was such a major breakthrough, something which totally uncovered space and started space exploration big time. But I would never want to conclude that that's the only thing that has happened. And since then, we have spent 50 years spending a lot of money but doing nothing. Because we have learned to live and work in space, which I think is... that's a major achievement and also a necessary achievement to make further progress. We've sent missions to the sun, like with Solar Orbiter and the Parker probe that got very, very near not too long ago. We've sent missions to Mars, to Venus, to all the other planets. We've sent the two Voyagers far outside the solar system. So I think there's many, many very, very important exploration missions which still give us science data. Still now, years and years later.
But and they're not astronauts, and they're not the inspirational.
They are different. They are different. Well, I find the Voyagers incredibly inspirational because they've been around for so long, and they are so incredibly far away, 25 billion kilometers away or something. So that's really, they are amazingly far away. So that makes it very special.
What do they do?
I think they did a lot. They went away to study Neptune and Uranus and Jupiter, the furthest away planets in our solar system. But now they're far beyond, and they still have some instruments active. Most of them have been switched off to save power. But the ones that are still active, they are there and they measure. Basically, they measure the nothing. And it turns out there is not really nothing. There's still a lot of stuff flying around that we don't understand very well. So I think these measurements are still important and inspirational. And there's a discussion of whether maybe these Voyagers should be switched off, because it still takes a team in NASA to follow them. But on the other hand, it's the furthest object that we have in space. So I think we should not switch them off. As long as they keep working, we should benefit from them. And that will be only for a few more years, because then the nuclear generator that creates the power in these systems will have totally run out. that is something which inspires at least my curiosity, even though I know nothing about it. And that makes me think about my father, who always used to say when he was reading like a thesis that I wrote or so, said, the less I understand of it, the prouder I am. and I think I have a little bit of that feeling with these missions that are just above my comprehension level, but possibly within reach. So I find that very inspirational.
So they're kind of like the current explorers, because they're exploring something we don't know, trying to find answers to questions we don't know anything about. So they're exploring into areas we don't know.
Yeah, so that's fantastic, no? It will, in the end, all of these little things contribute to our understanding of the universe. And then you don't know when this is going to be useful. Like, I always give the example that, but Einstein, he invented like that space was curved in this general theory of relativity. It's subtle, useless when he invented it. But today you don't use the curvature of space in the formulas and the equations for GPS and navigation satellites. Then you would get the wrong result and your phone would not know exactly where it was. So, and that's 100 years later. So this is going to happen with the research that we do today as well.
Wow, so that's actually why we do space exploration. The real result is that we learn something that may benefit a lot, our whole society in the future.
At some to be defined moment in time, yes.
And of course, we're curious.
We're very curious.
Yeah, in the end, this is also what we, I believe, as a human species, did traveling around the world to discover new things. And now, like you mentioned, I think all the square meters on Earth are being explored. So,
how long is ISS going to be still in use, do you think?
Yeah, that's a very good question nowadays. Of course, it's planned to be in use until 2030. And all the participants in the ISS program have signed up for that. That means the United States and Europe and Canada and Japan and Russia. But now, of course, Elon Musk has been saying that he may want to dump it in the ocean in 2027, possibly to make funds available for his Mars ambitions.
Wait, so he's going to dump it in the ocean without the rest, everyone in ISS
actually
agreeing?
Normally that cannot happen because there's an intergovernmental agreement between these five space agencies. So let's hope that the world does not turn so crazy that we would actually do this. Because I think we can benefit for very nicely for the remaining 5 years. And by that time, then we will actually make it descent and probably it will then, they will make it burn up in the atmosphere over Point Nemo, which is the point in the Pacific Ocean, which is the furthest away from any populated area. And if we do that in 2030, by that time, there will very likely be a couple of candidates for a commercial space station, which probably uses also inflatable modules, so it can be create somewhat bigger space in such a space station and be put together with fewer launches than we needed for the ISS. So I think there's still a future for research in the low Earth orbit around Earth, so we're pretty close in the area where also the International Space Station is. But okay, we don't know when that transition is going to happen, and I hope that we actually will make it until 2030.
Okay, so are we going to still have any governmental input or just commercial space?
What the commercial party said there, we can build such a new space station, and that means that then the governments can move out of the way and do the next too difficult stuff. So that's, I think, is the model. It's like the governmental work is done for things that have too high risk, take too long, are too expensive, and are not yet mature. And so they can do these things where commercial parties are not yet interested. But once the technology gets more mature, you can outsource it to commercial companies. Like today, if you want to have a communication satellite, you're not going to need an ESA or NASA or anything. You just go to a company who can build such a satellite and you go, please launch it for me and then I have my satellite. Because it's a mature technology. And the same thing is also happening for things like space stations. So space technology is going fast nowadays.
Yeah.
Well, then I'm Again, thank you very much for your passionate story about space exploration. Maaike, it's time for the fun fact.
Well, thank you, Martijn.
Are the moon boots coming from the moon?
Was the moon landing actually real?
We all now know. Let's hear it for Maaike's fun fact.
Maaike's fun.
So, fun fact for today. Something I hope people don't know yet. I hope, Philip, maybe I'll surprise you with the fun fact.
Try me.
Which is one of my favorites. And I tried to find the history behind this fact. And actually, the history is kind of like this. There's a NASA engineer. His name is Frank Frudi, a NASA engineer. And he worked on Saturn V and the Apollo rockets. And he decided to move to Oregon, again, of course, the States, for his passion of skiing. But skiing wasn't, back then, very comfortable yet. So he tried to apply his engineering expertise to create more comfortable ski boots. And he went to 23 companies, got rejected, then ended up at Nike. And he adapted the technology called blow rubber molding, which was actually developed for spacesuit helmets to create this strong outer shell where you can fill it with compressed gas. Now, maybe you can already think about where I'm going with this. The design was patented in 1979, and it is now used for cushioning footwear because it allows runners to run on air. So the Nike Air Max, one of my favorite shoes, I know Martijn is actually wearing one right now, is actually built on space technology that is patented by NASA to create a molding for pressurized gas to have more comfortable shoes. So anyone who's actually wearing Nike Air Max at the moment, you know, you're actually walking on space technology, real NASA engineering. So I think this is a really cool example of how technology, space technology, is actually being used in everyday life, making our life more comfortable and, of course, really cool.
I didn't know that, and I think you are very good at proving my point that exploration can be very useful. Because if this is technology coming from the Apollo missions to the moon,
right,
originally, that means that this is a very, very clear spin-off of what they did at that time. Now, the spin-off is not per se the only thing that you would want to go for, but if you have it as a free of charge extra byproduct, then you should be really happy with it.
Yes.
I really, really think this is cool.
Yeah, because it's your favorite shoe. I know it's your favorite shoe.
Yeah, I don't want to do any advertisements. So, but you're right. So again, Philip, thank you for joining this episode. I would like to mention that again, we're going to add some information in terms of the show notes about the updates from NL Space Camp as SBIC, and maybe as well some links about what Philip discussed.
So you can follow us online. Please like and follow and share. It's really good for our podcast. If you have any questions, if you have any tips, you can send an email to podcast@nlspacecampus.eu. And we may even feature your favorite speaker.
So Maaike, who's our next guest?
Well, actually, we don't know. So it's kind of like a mystery guest.
I like it. Let's have a mystery guest.
Thank you for listening.